ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of Anatolia Dispatch. Today, our guest is Dr. Chris Kilford, who's been with us a number of times before. And we're getting all sorts of wonderful feedback, Chris, about your participation in these. People are talking about how thoughtful and informative your sessions are. So we may be getting you back regularly if that works for you.
That's very nice to hear.
And I understand you're a little pressed for time because people are calling on you. If you could talk a little bit about, so let's get started. If you could talk a little bit about, I mean, yesterday you were giving a briefing to the Canadian Parliament. If you could just talk about that and the nature of that and where's that going in Turkish Canadian relations?
Yeah, most definitely. I was very honored actually to get a call from our parliament, the House of Commons, the Foreign Affairs Committee, to appear as a witness with a few others to talk about Canada's arms embargo on Turkey, which is causing all kinds of waves, especially of course if you're the Turkish government, they're not very happy with us. But you know, this is not the first time that Canada has had an arms embargo on Turkey. You can go back to 1974 as a start point for that. And we're not the only NATO country that has an arms embargo on Turkey right now. The U.S. has got various sanctions and many other NATO countries do as well. But this one particularly, I think, hurt in a way because it concerns Turkey's drone capability, and in particular it's Bayraktar TB2 drones that have been used so effectively in Syria, in Iraq, in Libya, and most recently in the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh.
In
Azerbaijan. Yeah. And I was the defense attaché to Azerbaijan. I think I've mentioned to this to you before, from 2011 to 2014, I was cross-accredited from Turkey. So I was very familiar with that conflict. It's been going on for close to 30 years. People often refer to it as a frozen conflict, but that's probably not the right term because a lot of people have been dying, you know, daily, weekly, monthly in that conflict as both sides traded fire between one another. So, what had happened was that Canada's been selling these Westcam surveillance and target acquisition pods to Turkey, which they use on the Bayraktar drones, with sort of an end user agreement that says, you know, they're for your use to defend Turkey. And then what we saw with Operation Peace Spring against the Syrian YPG, the use of those drones, it didn't go over very well. And we put on a temporary arms embargo to show our displeasure that they were being used against one of our allies, if you like, in Syria and fighting Daesh. It was sort of seen as counterproductive for Turkey to be attacking the YPG. And now if you're Turkish, of course, you have an entirely different view because for you, they're just simply an extension of the PKK. And this is about your national interests. So we had a clash of interests take place. There was a move, you know, to lighten the load of that arms embargo on a case-by-case basis. Canada would examine how things were going. But then we started to see the Bayraktar drones used very effectively to support the UN-backed government in Tripoli, the government of national accord. And the use of those drones, you know, arguably played a pivotal role in stopping General Haftar's advance on Tripoli. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's based on, you know, Canadian technology. I mean, Turkey builds these drones, as I'm sure your audience knows, but they're indigenous to a degree. Bits and pieces come from other countries, and we're providing, in some cases, engines from Canada, but those Westcam pods, which are arguably the brains, right? I mean, they're the thing that allows you to do what you do with drones. So suddenly, you know, Canadian technology is being used in a way we didn't expect to see it used. And then to put the icing on the cake, we have the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. Azerbaijan is very, very successful. And as I spoke yesterday to the parliamentary committee, I said arguably the Bayraktar drones were the most pivotal piece in the Azerbaijani inventory when it came to the fighting that we saw, instrumental in what was taking place, because the Bayraktar drones can loiter over the battlefield for 24 hours. There's nowhere to hide. And I think this was one of the things that's come out of this. If we didn't know it already, but you certainly do now, on a modern battlefield, there's nowhere to hide. It can be night or day. You can use camouflage, but these drones with their current capabilities can see right through this and give you a real marked edge. And so I spoke to the committee about this. Our arms embargo is now very clear. There'll be no sales of these Westcam cameras to the Turkish armed forces for their drones. And now Turkey will have to either build their own, and I believe Aselsan is looking at that, or acquire targeting pods from another country. But it won't be Canada.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I wanted to note is that there's been discussion in the United States about, you know, what sort of arms embargo we should have with Turkey, but it's all relative to the S-400 acquisition program. Our system works a little differently because in order for a weapons sale to go through, it has to go through the Department of Defense, but it also has to go through the Department of State. But most importantly, it has to be approved by committees like your House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee in both our Senate and our House. So there are four committees, a House Defense Committee, a House Foreign Affairs Committee, and a Senate Defense Committee and a Senate Foreign Affairs Committee that have to approve it. Now, there's not been a formal declaration that the United States is going to impose an arms embargo on Turkey. But I worked in the office that prepared arms transfers. I worked in the State Department office a number of years ago that prepared those arms transfers. And it's amazing how well those committees can simply by slow rolling, delaying, asking questions, never have to take a vote on an arms sale or transfer. And from friends of mine who are still working in the State Department, but also more importantly, open source reporting that's coming out of the press about what's going on Capitol Hill regarding the transfer of weapons systems to Turkey, there is actually a de facto embargo right now. And the press has reported on this. My guess is that the Turks are aware of it. They have some pretty smart people working at their embassy. And they're probably trying to explain this back to Ankara and their bosses in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. But what Canada is doing is a little more, you know, open and transparent. Do you get a sense of any blowback from Turkey at this point? Or is it just they're going to shop around, try to get Aselsan or somebody else to come up with the brain, as you say, because it really is the brain of the drones.
Yeah, I think it is. And we've discussed other friction points before between Canada and Turkey. And because it is such an important part of the overall drone program, the Westcam pods that are built here, it is going to be a friction point, and we already can see in the Turkish press and CNN Turk is asking me to talk about it in a day or so. So it is an issue, and really why it is an issue, of course, is because the Bayraktar drones have been so effective.
Right,
we see Russia waving a finger at Turkey right now over sales of drones to Ukraine. And why is that? Well, because they're such a game changer. They tip the balance, so to speak. And now, of course, Russia can always respond in whatever way they choose. But if you're just fighting in the Donbass or you know, on a limited scale with a competitor that's a peer competitor or has slightly less capabilities than you, these drones are like massive game changers. We've seen it now. In three cases, with the PKK/YPG in Libya and now in Nagorno-Karabakh. And everybody's taking note. You know, I'm an air defense officer, former air defense officer. I can imagine there are a lot of militaries around the world that are taking note and probably have been pretty complacent about this sort of thing, you know, aware that there's an issue with drones. But I would imagine that they're all looking at how to defeat the drones the cheapest way without investing huge sums, you know, whether you can jam them or what kind of camouflage, newer camouflage could you potentially use. I mean, people would be examining this. So eventually I would imagine something will catch up and sort of negate the drone capability that Turkey has to a degree, not always, you know, not totally. But definitely on the arms sales market, Turkey is offering, you know, reasonably priced drones that are incredibly effective. And from a Canadian perspective, I don't think our approvals for arms sales are that convoluted. And so when we do come out and have an arms embargo, it's pretty clear it's the government and you're not getting them, and you can't obscure this, you know. So, but then from the WESCAM perspective, the company, of course, is here in Canada. They sell to, I think, 70-odd countries. They have so many customers. This will put a slight dent in their market. But on the other hand, what Libya has shown and what Nagorno-Karabakh has shown is that not only are the Bayraktar drones very effective, but the WESCAM pods are also incredibly effective. And it's not just the case of shooting things, if you know, but simply survey from a surveillance perspective. I would imagine, you know, WESCAM would be very pleased with the way their product is functioning.
I mean, one of the things. So you probably know, at one point I was teaching at the Inter-American Defense College, and one of the things that the Colombian officers talked about was how the drone technology was going to dramatically improve their ability to fight narco traffickers. I mean, there are all sorts of applications of these things, and they don't have to be battlefield applications, which of course means that there's a market, as you said, for WESCAM, even if they lose the Turkish Bayraktar drone contract. So let's since you touched on it, mentioning the sale to Ukraine of these, you know, there's been a movement of a significant amount of Russian military personnel and material to the border region with Ukraine. There have been, I wouldn't say overly urgent, but there have been discussions among different NATO partners about how should NATO respond to this apparent buildup. Is this a threat to Ukraine? From your perspective of the other North American NATO partner, where do you think, you know, how does this play into Turkey's relations with NATO? What's going on with Ukraine and Russia at this point?
Yeah, so yesterday when I spoke to a parliamentary committee, I said that I couldn't think of any military that, and I'm talking about the Turkish military, any other military that, you know, is so engaged right now in various conflicts, either directly or indirectly. The only comparison I had was Russia. And there we go. That says it all. Where do you find that, you know, look at Turkey and Russia, of course, whether it's Idlib or in the northern part of Syria, that the two are either facing off with one another or working with one another. So you have that. Then you move over into Libya where, you know, we believe Russia was supporting General Haftar. Certainly Turkey was supporting the UN government in Tripoli. Right. Again, facing off there. Switch over to Nagorno-Karabakh. Again, facing off in that particular area. It's like we've gone back, I don't know, 300 years, like when Crimea was carved off of the Ottoman Empire in 1783 by the Russians, you know, and then we move forward and we have, you know, to Crimea and many, many other wars between the two. And here we go. It's 2021 and we see Turkey and Russia facing off all through the region, draw the line from Tripoli all the way through to Baku. And now you toss on Ukraine. where Russia, of course, would be looking at this and saying, well, we're not happy that you're supporting Ukraine. We're not happy with the whole situation. There's a show of force on the Russian side with that buildup that you just spoke about. The hard thing with these things is, you know, most of us want to be, you know, optimistic about these things and just say, well, it's a show of force. And you know, NATO's boasted about having the biggest exercises ever, and then everybody goes home. So maybe they'll go home. But one thing I've learned in that particular region is to expect the unexpected, and the best analysis can lead you down the wrong path. You're just never quite sure how things are going to play out. One thing, though, with these drones, of course, that would annoy Russia, I would think, is that they can provide that surveillance 24 hours a day and watch for troop movements. And yes, there are other capabilities. There are satellites and reconnaissance airplanes and you name it. But what the drones are doing is giving you this round the clock surveillance capability, which you know, is often missing. And if you know, switch back to the PKK, for example, yes, I mean, Turkey has surveillance airplanes, they have fighter jets and helicopters and that sort of thing, but sustaining you know, combat air patrols and reconnaissance patrols 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with platforms with people in them is very, very hard. Here you go with the drones giving you this 24/7 coverage in sometimes terrible weather. You're still able to do it. And now you're really pinning people down. You know, this is really key. There's nowhere to hide night or day. I remember being in the military, and at nighttime we thought, well, you know, now we can drive around and we can move positions and set up, and you can't do that anymore. As was shown with the drone footage that we got out of the Azeris, showing their, you know, Armenian troops being engaged so effectively and losing huge number of tanks and other things. So, so it all points to the fact that we really haven't progressed, Ed, for the last 300 years. When I do my talks, and you've heard me say this before, dig up Mustafa Kemal Ataturk, dig up Gertrude Bell, dig up any one of those fine characters from 100 years ago, bring them back to life, and they would just ask you, why haven't you done anything to make things better? It's worse. So this is where we sit. And
there's an interesting, you know, intersection here. Canada, you know, rightly put on an arms embargo because basically Turkey violated the end user agreement. I'm quite familiar when the United States has end user agreements when we export things. All countries do. Not all, but most do. And certainly they do for the really best technology they have available for sale. Those they put very strict requirements on. So Canada was well within its rights, and it made perfect sense. But now we have a situation where the Ukrainians could really use those Bayraktar drones. But with the Westcam pod, because as you said, the pod really is the brain. It really makes the thing valuable. But the Bayraktar is at a price point that, quite frankly, the Turks can afford. And let's be honest, you know, the United States has all sorts of drone products out there on the market, but they tend to be pricier than anybody else. The United States does not do inexpensive technology.
No.
You know,
this, Kerry, there's a lot to unpack here. You know, yes, Canada's annoyed that our technology was being used in ways that we didn't really expect it to be used. And and so I do understand that. However, let's just look at this for a second. First of all, Turkey's fighting the PKK. I have been since 1984. Canada labels the PKK as a terrorist organization. So the fact that they're using them against the YPG, yes, we're annoyed because they are helping us against Daesh and potentially constraining Bashar al-Assad. I get all that, but you know, from a Turkey's perspective, it's about their own internal security.
Right.
So, okay, that's fine. But then switch over to Libya. If not for the drones and Turkey's intervention, and it did get messy, so I'm not trying to paper over any of that. But if not for that intervention, the United Nations recognized government would have fallen.
Right.
Probably.
Yeah.
And so that intervention stopped General Haftar. It's led to negotiations. It looks like we'll have elections. And, you know, we have to be a tiny bit optimistic and hope that the situation resolves itself in some way. So the Canadian supplied West Cam pods on those drones had actually a pivotal role in stabilizing the situation. And from a United Nations perspective, you would have think that was a good thing, right?
Right.
When you're switching over to Nagorno-Karabakh, it gets a little bit messier. But, you know, Azerbaijan has a fair claim to say that not just Nagorno-Karabakh was occupied or, you know, taken in the earliest stages of the war, but much of their territory outside of Nagorno-Karabakh was occupied by Armenia. Right. So it was within their, you know, sovereign rights to try to reclaim that territory by whatever means they could. And obviously the diplomatic side wasn't working. You know, but for us, it's very sensitive. We have a very big Armenian diaspora here. They didn't like what was happening. I mean, a lot of Armenian soldiers and Nagorno-Karabakh soldiers were being killed. And so they, you know, I think rightfully said, this isn't right.
You
know, Canada shouldn't be playing a part in this. If we're going to play a part, it should be on the diplomatic side. We shouldn't be using, our technology shouldn't be using to basically turn the tide of that conflict.
Right. Except so, now we have to, I'm glad you brought it up. You know, I do that great intersection of politics and military, right? So there's a large Ukrainian diaspora or Ukrainian ethnic ancestry Canadians. I mean, it's one of the largest identifiable ethnic groups in Canada is Ukrainian Canadians.
And that was in the back of my mind when I was giving my testimony. And I did make reference to it in my written remarks that Russia actually was angry at Turkey. And I was doing that. I said it because if you're here, if you're Ukrainian Canadian, you would actually be what you might want to, and I can't speak for the Ukrainian community or all of them, or I would say, but look, I think you'd be saying, those Bayraktar drones could actually be very, very useful for us in maintaining our sovereignty and keeping an eye on what is happening in the southeast. And therefore, we would love to see Turkey selling these drones. We want to see Ukraine as part of NATO. I think many Ukrainians would say that.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, there would be a community perhaps that would say, no, let them have the Westcam pods so that we can sell. And this speaks to the whole business of selling arms, right?
Right, right.
Good old Canada is one of the top 20 world arms exporters. We often don't think of Canada that way. Our number one market other than the U.S. is the Middle East. 80% of our arms exports go to the Middle East. And so we put an arms embargo on Turkey initially for human rights issues and then for, you know, extending it and cementing it for Nagorno-Karabakh and so forth. But we start off by saying, oh, well, it's human rights. But here we are selling billions of dollars of light armored vehicles to Saudi Arabia, which has a not a very good human rights record. So, you know, people, observers might say, well, hang on, why are you stopping it there but allowing it here? Well, yes. I mean, the Saudi contract is worth about $14 billion Canadian and employs 3,000 Canadians at the factory. And people will argue, well, the light armored vehicles are not being used for in Yemen, so we don't really have anything to do with that. But that's just, you know, argument.
I mean, I think it's really good to bring this up because I think it's important for people to understand that there are, beyond the contractual obligations inside an end user agreement, there are always other considerations. And, you know, some people tend to think that, you know, the decision about whether you export arms to a particular country or not is really kind of a decision made between the arms industry and you know, the government. And there's no other influence. There's no other stakeholders, as sometimes we say. Mm-hmm. There are people who have the human rights concerns, but there's also the ethnic communities. I mean, your country and my country share this. The chairman mm-hmm. of our Senate Foreign Relations Committee effectively depends on the money from the Armenian American community to fund his reelection campaigns every 6 years. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Senator Menendez from New Jersey, the Hispanic community backs him because of their the ethnic connection and all that. But what's little known is that he has always been forcefully on the side of the Armenian community and the Armenian diaspora. And that's just the nature of the politics in the country. And that happens anytime you have a representative democracy where the people are elected by the citizens, you're going to get a disparity of views and you're going to get a situation where, yeah, right now in Canada, as you said, there are probably Ukrainian Canadians who would love to see Turkey selling Westcam equipped drones to Ukraine. Yeah. Meanwhile, the Armenian community is still, let's just say, angry that the Turks used Westcam-equipped drones very effectively to recover a lot of territory they had lost going back to, I think, 1992.
Yeah.
So, it's a very good point about how complicated and messy this stuff gets.
Yeah, I think there would be lots of people in the Ukrainian community here that would also say, you know, don't sell those drones because we don't need any more piling on, so to speak. We need diplomatic solutions to, mm-hmm. to what we're seeing. You know, when I look at the people that immigrate to Canada and we bring in 300,000 to 400,000, the number is going to go up, immigrants every year. They're often coming from conflict zones. We have 73,000 Syrians that we've brought in since about 2015 who are now here in Canada and many others, of course. I would say the majority would say, look, we don't want arms sold to countries that we know are going to actually use them.
Right.
You can sell weapons to the Dutch and the Belgians. And the Norwegians, bless their hearts, I just use them as examples, and you probably know that they're not going to be used, or if they ever were to be used, that they would be used in lawful ways, expecting right. rules of engagement and so forth. But the moment you decide to sell weapons to, let's say, other countries, then you're not sure, right? The moment it leaves the door, end user certificate or not, you're never going to be quite sure, and you can get caught off guard. And I think that's what happened in the Canadian situation. We just got a little bit caught off guard that maybe because it was just pods on a drone, it's not like you were selling a rifle or a rocket or something. How could it ever be a problem? And then all of a sudden it is.
You really kind of alluded to this when you mentioned the fact that Canada is one of the top 20 arms exporters. Well, you know, I think the general public tends to think of arms exports as tanks and planes and real, real big, heavy hardware. Mm-hmm. So much more of it nowadays is technology and it's high tech. But exactly. As you've made quite clear, without that Westcam pod for the surveillance and the targeting and all that, the Bayraktar is not anywhere near as effective as it would be without it. So, I'm looking at the clock and I'm afraid we're going to be running out of time. And I know that you have something else. The last time we spoke, you touched really briefly on these 103 admirals who wrote a letter complaining about the so-called Bosporus Canal, Istanbul Canal, 10 of whom later got rounded up by the government on I don't know what charges. And I haven't been following that real closely. But I wanted you to expand on that a little bit, because what you were talking about was the fact that factions have not disappeared from the military, that the cleaning out, and whether you want to call them the purges or we'll use that great Rumsfeld term, the lustration of the military after the coup, the cleaning up and polishing of the military after the coup, in 2016, has not finally resolved the issues of factions within the military and within the government writ large. And if you could just take that and talk about that in with the perspective of these admirals.
Yeah, so the admirals, but let me just start by saying I'm reading Jeremy Fever's new book on the Menderes period. And it's really, I mean, I know a fair bit about that period, but it's always great to have another perspective. And you have groups of officers that are forming in Istanbul and Ankara in the 1950s, all looking to see how they can plot together to get rid of the Menderes government. And then you fast forward to the 2016 coup with the Gulen movement and Gulen officers. And then here we are then 2021. And in the Turkish newspapers, you see a rear admiral wearing religious robes and a turban over his uniform. And from a, say, a North American perspective, you might think, well, that's a bit silly, you know,
right,
that you would do that. But from a Turkish perspective, that is, again, another bomb going off in this never-ending struggle between, simply put, the secular world and the religious world, and to see a military officer in religious garb, it just sort of brought it all home to people that these different groups exist. People get together on religion, but you know, from a North American perspective, we have. I'm always amazed when I look at the American military about how religious it is, and mm-hmm. It's actually a shock, I think, for many Canadian officers to see how religious the American military is. Not everyone, but I remember passing a room at a training establishment, and there was a prayer circle with officers holding hands, and I my jaw dropped because I just never see that in a Canadian context. But of course, you know, we have imams in our military here, and we have chaplains and so forth. Right. But in the Turkish context, it's horrible, you know, when you for the secular world to see a rear admiral yeah. wearing religious garb. But it just points to, again, the polarization in the society, the fact that officers are grouping together. And I would arguably say that they're grouping together more so than in the past, because they're under threat. I mean, under constant threat. And when you're under constant threat, you are looking for some kind of security. So I would say that, you know, what we're seeing is a bit of it's a normal manifestation of the unrest. It's an unrest that Turkish military officers would not, it's not new to them,
right?
Whether right. you joined 100 years ago or yesterday, it is remarkable that we still see this situation. And why do we? Because Turkey has never realized yet a full, you know, experience proper democracy where you can have an opposition, and although you may insult one another back and forth across the aisle, the skins are pretty thick and life goes on when you're outside of the chamber. But it's not that way in Turkey, as we know. The media is, whenever there's an issue, always shut down. It just seems to go in a cycle in Turkey. We're in another one of those cycles. And the reason why you get these little groups and cliques and hideaway people that hide their affiliations and try not to show that they're religious, or maybe show they're religious because they can gain favor in some fashion, it's all because there's this lack of real democracy. Yes, I know there's a ballot box, and I know people go and vote and all of this, but it's that lack of real sense of democracy that's not there, and it just invites problems. Yeah.
I mean, I think the attempt by Erdogan to reverse the 2019 elections in Istanbul and tentatively in Ankara, the mayoral elections, which failed, and everyone had a great deal of optimism about Turkish democracy after that, but you might say that in a sense slowed the rot. It's like taking fruit that's starting to go bad and refrigerating it it doesn't stop the rot. It just slows it. And you have to stop the rot and then really start building back. I think your point about opposition is very important. The notion of a loyal opposition of people who they may be your opponents in an electoral sense, but they're not your enemies. They are not enemies of the Republic. They are not enemies of the state. They disagree. They have a different point of view, but that doesn't mean they're disloyal. And that it's not only Turkey. There are many countries around the world where that notion has never taken quite the hold that it must in order to have a really functioning representative democracy. So,
I would say in Turkey, Ed, the opposition is just viewed by the other side as being disloyal.
Yeah.
And this stifles everything. And then, of course, added on to everything is that the elephant in the room when you're in Turkey is the Kurdish situation. And the moves that we've been seeing taking place most recently means that the Kurdish issue is always going to be there. Well, always, but it's not gone away. It's also, you know, having a truth and reconciliation with the Kurdish community, it needs to be done, because otherwise Turkey, it just, we held back.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's essentially they're taking one fifth of their country, and excluding them from participation in society, in politics, in the economy. And, you know, I remember the whole story that Erdogan wanted to grow the economy of Turkey to the point where it was one of the top 10. Mm-hmm. And it was like top seven. It was the 17th at the time was doing that. And I remember the discussions I had with visitors from Washington saying, it's never going to happen as long as one fifth of the population of the country is held back from contributing to the economic development of the country. So like when you look at statistics saying, well, there are 83 million Turks, well, but if you know what, 10, 12, 11 million of them are excluded from really participating, really using their talents fully in the country, you're basically talking about having a country of 70 million, and they're not going to be able to do as well as a country of 83 million. Yeah. I think we've run out of time. You mentioned that you have something to get to. I would love to talk about Afghanistan next. So think about when your schedule is going to allow for that.
Yeah.
And
we could also talk about, you raised it, just you mentioned it briefly. It's the HEDEF 2023 goals that Turkey had.
Yeah.
Set in place a few years ago, all the things that they wanted to realize by 2023. And because of circumstances, both in their control and outside of their control, not a single one of those goals will be met.
Not a single one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be good. I mean, that would be good. So, you know, let me know whether you would like to do this again in a week or so or 2 weeks or so. Certainly neither the Afghan issue nor the HEDEF issue is going to go away anytime soon. I'll let you get to your next event, and do let us know if you get on CNN Turk, because I want to see that.
I will. I'm humbled to be able to speak to you on these subjects, and thank you to the audience for listening.
All right. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up with Dr. Chris Kilford for this session of Anatolia Dispatch, part of Aval Pod. Thanks very much.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. thank you for listening to our podcast.